I'm John Emery, Professor of Primary Care Cancer Research at the University of Melbourne. I'm part of the research team responsible for Data for Decisions, a Department of General Practice research initiative. We're creating a repository of data from de-identified electronic medical records. This is a very exciting project that we want GPs and the public to know about. Data for Decisions opens enormous possibilities for the generation of knowledge to improve healthcare practices, services, and health outcomes. Our data privacy, security, and governance measures are second to none. Keep watching to learn more about Data for Decisions and look at our website.
I'm Dr. Shane Huntington. We're here to discuss the Data for Decisions research initiative being undertaken by the University of Melbourne's Department of General Practice. Beside me is Dr. Jane Crowe. She's a GP who wants to know more about the program to help her decide whether or not to involve her practice. To discuss the program, we have here at the table two of the lead researchers, Associate Professor Dougie Boyle and Dr. Joanne Mansky-Nankervis, who happens to also be a GP. We also have Tricia Greenway providing a community voice and Dr. Malcolm Clark, a GP who is supportive of this project. Dougie, I sort of want to start with you here because you've sort of led a lot of this. It's called research, the research program is called Data for Decisions. Yep. Can you tell us what data we're talking about and what sort of decisions we're actually looking into?
Okay, thanks Shane. Well, what is a bit of a gap in Australia right now is having good primary care data. And we're talking about in particular routinely collected data that is collected during consultations. And the challenge we have is that if you want to improve healthcare, you really need to be able to look at the patient journey of care right from even when you're out in the community before general practice, but certainly here we want to be able to have primary care data contributing into research right across the journey of care prior to hospital admission with if you come down with something, but also following up what happens to you. And researchers use that sort of data to try and impact and improve ways we can treat patients to improve outcome.
And in terms of the research program itself, I mean, what would a GP have to actually do? What does it look like for them?
Okay, so in terms of any work for the GP, the system just sits there in the background, and once a week information contributes into the Data for Decisions repository. So initially, there's probably a couple of hours work there whilst we help set up some technology for them. Later on in the program, there are some exciting things that we're aiming to do, which might be intervention projects, maybe that Joanne can talk to more, but certainly we want to, if we involve GPs in any of that, it's through further, further asking them if they want to be involved in projects like that. But these are some of the exciting ones where it might directly change the way consultations happen. Mm.
Joanne, what sort of projects are we talking about here that people would benefit from?
Yeah, sure. So I think a really important thing to acknowledge is that over 80% of people in Australia are going to be visiting their general practice at least once a year. Yet a lot of the studies that are carried out in health actually aren't carried out in the general practice setting. So we don't always know actually how applicable those trials and that research is to most of the people in the community. And that's why we think it's really important that we have this initiative, the Data for Decisions initiative. There's a lot of different kinds of work that we can do with this. As Dougie mentioned, we can look at the journey that somebody has from the community through primary care through to the hospital and think about, okay, so what does the data tell us about maybe being able to pick somebody up earlier in that journey and maybe to be able to intervene and stop them from ending up in the hospital? Might be something as simple as a quality improvement project in a general practice to help them identify people that might be at high risk of developing a heart attack in the next 5 years so that they can do something about it and they can look at the data that we provide back to them to see if that has been effective. The other thing it could do is when we are carrying out randomised controlled trials in general practice, we might be able to help the GPs to find people in their practice that might most benefit from participating in those trials. And I think as a last point, just following on from what Dougie said, a really key part of this is that we do have data and we do have decisions. So this is certainly not a case of just taking lots and lots of data from general practice and us publishing studies about epidemiology. In fact, what we want to do is take that data and then think, okay, how can we feed this back to develop interventions or tools that then can help GPs and patients make decisions together about how we can optimise their health.
Mm. Are there examples that have already kind of been put in place? I mean, the language here is very projective towards the future, but are there examples you can give where this sort of use of data has been valuable to GPs and or their patients?
Well, this is a very new project for us. There has been similar projects that have been used targeting different quality improvement initiatives, and we certainly know that audit and feedback is quite effective tool for GPs to look at their practice, can maybe compare themselves to their peers, and then maybe think about developing something that they can do at the practice level that suits both the way their practice works and also the community that they serve. In relation to data for decisions, we've already got some really exciting projects, that will be underway, including one that will be linking general practice data to hospital data for cancer and thinking about how can we look at diagnosing people in an appropriate, timely manner to stop them from going to hospital in the future. Mm. So there's lots of exciting ways that this data can be used.
Mm. Tricia, you're the sort of consumer voice at the table. you're the one that has to be convinced in a way, amongst others. But how does the consumer voice sort of see this sort of project? I mean, where's the interest from your perspective?
I've got sort of two aspects to that question. And following on from your talk about the use of it or past uses, I've got an experience of quite some years ago working with the Division of General Practice. And it was working with that division that I actually got together to find out that they had some evidence that they had gathered because they'd asked a different question. Yeah. And that actually had an enormous impact on it. The issue ended up feeding into what we got from that practice, feeding into something becoming a national goal and target.
That's
and
fantastic.
Because it was so credibly gathered, you know, from GP data that was collected with patients at that time. So it was a small project, but when we magnified it, it made a real change. And the other thing that I've discovered when I talk to consumers, and I do a lot of listening too, I hope, is the fact that when you ask people about being involved in any sort of research gathering, they always say, well, if it helps. And they like to be reassured that they're part of something that's going to, even if it doesn't benefit them immediately, that it will input into some good for the community. And I tested this out this morning with a group that I talked to, and they were just saying, oh, that just sounds like plain good common sense. And they didn't raise, because they were a particularly acute group of aware people, they didn't raise a lot of objections, but they did just ask, so are people going to be reassured that this data is going to be, you know, safely managed? And we talked a little bit about the de-identification aspect of it. Mm. And they all just said, oh, that sounds really good. It'll probably take a while. They even saw that immediately.
Yeah.
Take a while, but it really will be a contributor to what often people talk about is the lack of evidence. Mm. And they say, we're not talking about scientific evidence. We're talking about the evidence of what's worked for us.
Hmm.
And what may not have worked for us, and what might be better to do in the future. So I've only floated it, as I say, to a few groups, and I haven't had a great deal of negative response, and the idea being that they did say to me, how can you reassure them? And I said, because I know I've asked Dougie the question already with quite some detail to get the ideas to how do you answer people who are nervous. And they came in and with really, really strong questions again, and I was able to answer them. And particularly with that term that you've got a data steward.
They really
liked the sound of that for anyone who was feeling a bit nervous about it all. And that the university was going to take charge of that sort of process.
Malcolm, you're a GP who's engaged in this project, so you're converted. How did you get to that point? I mean, you have a business to run. This is a big deal, and there's a patient trust here that you have to make sure you link in with well.
Sure.
Why is this research important in your sort of context as a GP?
Well, I suppose my conversion has been in relation to how fabulous the wealth of knowledge we can get out of our GP mm-hmm. data. So following on to what Joanne was saying, we usually use hospital groups to do research on, and they're not really representative of the community. So when we give information back to the community, we're talking about a very specific small group. And, you know, we have a fantastic amount of information in our general practice. Some of it is not as clean as we'd like, but, you know, again, looking at something like this will help the GPs and the people want their data to be of better quality so that it can be used for what Trish was saying, the expectation that if GPs collect data on your behalf, that we use it for reasons that are going to help the community. So, you know, we talk about our desire to do research from an academic perspective, but then that trickles down to grassroots GPs like me, and I'm speaking as a GP here, as well as to my consumers and my patients. Mm-hmm. So the thing that gets me in with this sort of stuff is we can't just sit down and ignore the quality of this data and just leave it on our servers at our office. We need to actually bring it out and find a use for it.
Joanne, sharing of data is a controversial issue, whether it's financial data or other data. When we get to health, people get really edgy about that.
Yeah.
How do we go about, you know, making both consumers but also GPs that have custodial control of this data feel comfortable with this project?
I think that's a really important question, Shane, and it's something that we've literally spent years working to this point.
We have.
Because we have a very strong commitment to doing whatever we can to protect people's privacy, to make them feel confident, to show them what kind of ways that how we're using their data and how that might improve their care. Now, I, just as everybody on the table here, will come to this from multiple different angles. I've got my own records sitting on a GP's system. So that makes me think about how will my personal data be used. I'm a GP. It makes me think about actually how I use electronic medical record, how I talk to patients. And thirdly, obviously, from an academic standpoint. So what I can say is that we've spent a lot of time and we're going to continue to evolve this to make sure that we keep up with best practice, a strong governance framework. We've got technology that can de-identify data before it even leaves the practice of both patients but also the GPs and health professionals, which we think is something that's a bit unique. We have ethical procedures, so every time somebody wants to access the data for research, they have to have ethics approval. Our program of work has undergone ethics process here at the University of Melbourne. And we also do have legal expertise in our data governance committee to make sure that legally we are doing everything that we can to protect that data and deal with it appropriately.
Dougie, the software that you've developed that this whole program is based on, the Granite tool, takes this into account. It's been used for quite some period already successfully, is that right?
Granite, the research and the implementation started 12 years ago now, just as of last week. And the reason for building it, which is probably important, is because of some of the challenges in particular with having general practice, having lots of private businesses out there. Australia's got lots of concerns, and general practices are very keen to make sure that patients are protected. So from the start with this software, the brief and the thoughts were around how can we actually develop something that can give reassurances that when we actually use data, it can be used in the right way, because it's very easy to use data in the wrong way. So the system's been used in many settings, but in particular, some of the settings it's been used in are things like sexual health projects, where it's very sensitive data. So the reason it's been used in these particular settings is that we've worked with the different research groups to discuss, you know, just what is it that's required around the security provisions and how we can give as many guarantees as possible, or state that we've taken every step we possibly can to protect the data, all parts of the journey. So I think that's what we do.
The data security is one part, but Joan, the other part, of course, is consent from patients. How do you ensure that you actually have consent? I mean, there's a big difference between someone just agreeing to something like this and making sure that you have proper consent with these patients in the setting. So how do you go about this for this project?
Yeah, so there's two levels of consent, Shane. The first consent, obviously, is from the practices that are participating, so it's the health professional level. And then, as you mentioned, what do we do at the patient level? So what we have for this program of work is applied a concept called a waiver of consent. And that's consistent with current national NHMRC ethics guidelines. And a waiver of consent means that we don't need to seek specific informed consent from the patients that whose data we're extracting. And I'll just take a second to explain why, because I think it's a very important point. In a general practice, you might have up to 10,000 people that are attending your practice. So what our ethics statement says, one, is it practical to get informed consent from all of those people? I think that we would agree that it's probably not. The second thing is, are we going to be taking all of the precautions we can to de-identify those people to the extent that we can and to protect their data? So are we collecting names and things like that? Well, no, we are not. For that reason, we aren't seeking specific patient consent for their records to be transferred in. However, what we have done, that's not required by these ethics groups, but what we are saying is we do respect patients' wishes about their use of their data. And so patients will be able to have the right to withdraw. We're going to be advertising in the clinics that are participating with posters and pamphlets and things like that, and you know, working with practices if they're happy to put on their website, that kind of thing, so that people that are attending that practice are aware that they are participating. And if they do wish not to participate, then as part of the Granite tool, we've got a very simple tool that can just enter that patient's details, and then we will not be extracting any data that relates to that specific patient. So we're not doing this in secret. We do want the practices to be make it fully aware to their patients that they're participating in this, and we are respecting people's right to withdraw if they do not. But we are really doing this for the public good. We feel that even though there are some people that would prefer not to share their data, there are a lot of people that, as Tricia mentioned, would like their data to be used, as long as it's done in a safe way that respects their privacy, to help generate important data that can be used to hopefully improve the health of the community.
Tricia, I might just get your response on that, because this idea of 10,000 odd patients and not all of them being completely aware but being able to opt out. I mean, as the consumer representative, does that feel like a reasonable approach?
Yes, and as you were talking, I was thinking that there's actually a role here for the consumer organisations. And I think in making consumer organisations, so I would suggest actually that this project makes a communication effort with some of those big consumer bodies and talks about it in a way that they appreciate, which is we're going to get answers to questions that we mightn't get anywhere else because they know that this methodology is going to gather their experiences, you know, and their outcomes to make a real contribution. And every group I talk to really, really does like to think that they're contributing to further knowledge and that maybe somebody doesn't have to put up with something that they have to.
Very good.
You know, it's a real point of observation with people. Yeah. But I do think that it does need so that there's not a big use of time in explaining this to a person's, you know, personal appointment. That there does need to be information out in the office, and there does need to be a broader communication strategy, a bit of excitement about it all. Right? So it's not hard to do. There are organisations that have websites and all sorts of things, and I do think to make it easier on the practitioner, as we were talking about earlier, if there's an awareness out there before they even hit the surgery. And I think that wouldn't be too hard to do. So, and I think it would be effective.
So, Dougie, I mean, we've talked a lot about the consumers being de-identified here, but what about the practitioners themselves? How do they fit into that scheme?
Okay. Well, we're actually treating practitioners exactly the same way as we are patients. And we think this is fairly unique. I'm sure it's not entirely unique, but the system de-identifies the practitioners, in fact all of the staff, so any information that goes into the computer system and comes out as part of the research program is completely de-identified. We want to be able to do things like quality assurance programs. So interestingly, what it means is that on occasion we want to pass information back to help the practice. And one of the clever things is within the practice can use a sort of lookup list, an electronic list, to re-identify who the staff are or other things within the safety and the confines of the practice. So that's one of the key things about this, is that we're able to enable quite sophisticated abilities for improvement and quality assurance, and yet that central data, we truly can't tell who anyone is from it.
Are you able to track patients that go to multiple clinics so that their data is usable no matter where they go as well?
Yeah, excellent question, and it is a really exciting part of the program. The answer to that is yes. And you know, it is a kind of complicated concept to work out how that happens, but basically what we are able to do is, while the data is still in the confines of the practice, we're able to use a technique called cryptographic hashing. I'll not get any more technical than that. But essentially what it means is that we're able to generate signatures that are fairly unique in representing who someone is. And we can generate the same signature somewhere else. And that signature doesn't contain your identifiable, you know, who you are. It's derived from it mathematically. So what it means, to, in a nutshell, is without knowing who you are, we can use mathematics and numbers to say there's a very high probability we're talking about the same individual from different settings. So that means, yes, we can hook up that primary care data to other clinics that you might have been to, but also it means that we can undertake some of the research, like the work Joanne was talking about earlier, where we're linking up primary care data to hospital cancer data, so that we can actually see what's happening across the board there.
Jane, you're one of the ones that we have to convince you.
What do you think of that? Please, let me answer any further questions you have on that.
What sort of information would you actually need to feel comfortable signing up to something like this and recommending it to your many GP friends?
Well, first of all, I think the whole idea is a great idea. The primary care research is great, and the medical record is an untapped data well that would be fantastic to help doctors and patients and research. But I'm just trying to understand it from the nitty-gritty and the general practice day-to-day basis. Firstly, just the security of the patient data that Dougie was talking about, because once this information has left our practice, it's escaped and we don't know where it's going, and so we're trusting you to be looking after it and in ethical ways, and that's very good for the next 4 or 5 years. But what happens 10 years down the track? Will government want to sort of get hold its information for Medicare reasons or APRA, or, you know, we need that to be really clear who has governance over the data. and they'll be used for good and not evil, basically. Forever, you know.
Good or not drug companies.
Yeah, exactly.
Pharmacy. Maybe.
Yeah, so that's one thing that I'd be thinking about.
Yeah.
And how easy will it be for practice to complain or to opt out of this data for decisions if we're not happy with this process?
Jim, we might take these one at a time. Do you guys want to respond to that?
Oh, well, look, absolutely. So, I mean, I think one thing that's a wee bit different about this project is the fact that it is the, you know, the university here that is undertaking it. You know, so it's not some private company or organisation. And, you know, that certainly the University of Melbourne has high ideals and expectations of our staff as well.
Mm.
So Joanne was mentioning the 2 years that we've spent trying to work through how can we do this, and in fact it has taken us those 2 years. Mm-hmm. And what it's resulted in is us having an independent data governance committee.
Will the GP be on that?
Yes, absolutely. Mm. Yeah, in fact more than one, as well as as consumer representation. We've got legal representation as well that Joanne mentioned. I'm the data steward for the project, so I'm not on that committee, but I actually am answerable to things that happen coming out of that committee, and answerable to the chief investigator of the project. I'm here then to work with the university security teams. I've got a cybersecurity team. We've got their main IT teams. And we work with them as we have done for quite a number of years now. So we've got quite a lot of experience in doing this. And we work with them to proactively check things like the security is as good as we can make it. We've got standard operating procedures. And we do things like proactive risk register so that we're thinking all the time what could happen here.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if something does go wrong, what do we do next? Mm-hmm. So basically what we're doing is taking things as far as we can in these areas to try and secure things for everybody here. And of course the data is de-identified as well, which is something else to remember, and that the information that is there doesn't contain all that identifiable information. But a key part of the governance is you can potentially identify who someone is through what's in their data. Mm. So don't let me think we've not taken that into account. This is always at the back of our minds. And if people are coming in to do research projects, we want to know what data do they need. So we'll go through ethics review, but also through this governance committee, where questions like this are asked, what can we provide and how is it provided? And when groups apply for this, if we grant that approval, if the governance committee thinks that this is the right sort of project, then external parties would have to sign an agreement that goes over and above the law in terms of the steps we ask them to take and the things they can't do with that data. Okay, so we try to pin it down so that the uses are very restricted and managed. Mm-hmm. Okay, a bit of a long answer, but hopefully.
Will practices have access to their own data for quality assurance and improvement purposes, or will they be notified what research is coming out of this information?
Yes. Yeah. So the aim here is for complete transparency. So our website will have information of every project, and we also will be having an obligation on the research groups who are undertaking research for regular updates that will be on there. So it's not just someone asks for data and we never find out what happens to that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be in there. In terms of the quality assurance, some of our research projects are quality assurance projects.
Mm-hmm.
So the answer to that is absolutely.
So within the practice, we could apply and not have to go through months of ethics and stuff to get our own data, or maybe the local regional stuff.
Yeah, we're not going to be able to do that initially
because
we've not got enough staff resource just to do that.
Mm.
But certainly over the duration well, I don't know what that's going to be, but, you know, obviously for a long time. But what we will be doing through our quality assurance research projects is building up the resources to do these things more easily. Mm-hmm. So we want this to be something that works for practices, that's for sure.
What will be required by the GP when they're with the patient in the consultation at the computer?
Nothing.
Well, I'm concerned about when I see a patient, I might write my notes, a lot of them will be free-typed, I'll sign it off. Then if someone rings in, it'll still be, patient, I spoke with someone. And I'm concerned I might need to then tap on a telephone, and then a telephone consultation, not a surgery one, because it doesn't affect the consultation, but it will affect the data.
Yeah, look, I think that's a very important point. And I'll be honest with you, since I've been looking at general practice data, I actually have changed my behaviour and how I do use my electronic health record. Having said that, so there's two elements to that. One does improved data entry into the electronic health record help in this type of research program? Yes, it does. Because I think another important thing to note is, you know, for the data to decisions program, we can only take data from particular extractable fields within the electronic medical record. The second thing, though, I would say is in terms of processes like accreditation, making it easier if other GPs are looking after your patient while you're away, I would say that improved recording does actually help from a clinical standpoint. And then the third thing is we're very lucky that we've got a multidisciplinary team. So, for example, we've got statisticians that are going to be doing some work on this data to work out, okay, so if the GP doesn't fill out these fields and it comes up as missing data, how might that bias the results and how can we deal with that using statistical methods? There's also other computer science methods that we could look at employing so that GPs don't necessarily have to change their behaviour, but we can make the most of the data that they are entering. Mm-hmm.
I
was going to ask, you know, to explain a little bit more about that, about what sort of data can we extract from, and I think it's important because what Jane's been talking about is what we write in our little free text boxes. Can that data be seen?
Yeah. So just now we don't take that out, mainly because there can be a lot of privacy issues with some of the handwritten parts of the notes.
And spelling mistakes.
Yeah.
We've got ways of dealing with that, but
we can sometimes deal with spelling mistakes, but it's more around the privacy that we've got concerns about that. So we restrict what information we take that comes from textual sources for that reason. What we also do is, part of our system is to review the information that is coming through. So if we're getting anything that's inappropriate, we can deal with that immediately. So potentially that can happen. You can get people recording funny things in funny places. We're very specific. It's really quite interesting, though, that with the free text data, we can look for keywords, for instance. So there's been a couple of projects where we've started to do that. So what we've pulled out is the fact that a keyword was found rather than actually pulling out the patient notes. We have to be careful about what we take out.
I'm letting you run through your list here.
Yes, thank you. What will be the administrative load for the practice?
Okay, so we need to ask a few questions at the start of usually starting with practice manager just to try and find out where we can install the software, which just goes on one PC. There's a few question and answers there. And after that, it generally takes about an hour of liaison, usually with the practice IT person or support group, whoever looks after the IT, to get the software installed. After that, it's fully automated. So the only contact is if there's any occasional things that happen, like maybe if the overall practice, you know, there's a password changes or something, we might need to get in touch.
And we would like to hear from, we would like practices to always be displaying, for example, the poster to say that they're participating. Mm. And we would like to make sure that there are pamphlets available just so your patients are aware that the program is going on. Mm-hmm. And we'd be happy to help with that.
Mm-hmm. Will the patient know that they may be linked from one practice to the next practice if they're moving to different practices? That you mentioned earlier, they visit different doctors?
I'm trying to remember exactly what's in the leaflets. I think it certainly says that the information's used for being able to link to other resources potentially in different research projects. Mm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Anything else?
I'm just thinking. It was about the access, and I think that's about, we're talking about consent, which is very important, but you've already covered that, which is really good.
So do you feel comfortable with this sort of project? I mean, out at your clinic, would you be willing to sign up to this sort of project, given the discussion you've had?
Well, I am, but I have to my partners have to agree.
Yeah.
I would want to know what the costs are involved, either direct and indirect. So that would need to be sorted out before we were to sign up.
But it sounds like a lot of your fears have been put to bed.
Yes.
Yeah. Dougie, many of the practices all of the practices we're dealing with are profit entities, they're businesses, but what about the university and this program? Is this a profit-making scenario for the institution? How does that work?
Not at all. The university is a not-for-profit organisation, and in particular with this project, it's about trying to improve people's health outcomes at the end of the day. What we do have are costs just around being able to run the program. So we will have costs for researchers being able to access the data, but purely to cover overheads.
Dougie, we've talked a fair bit about the various bits of data coming out, but can you be specific about the sorts of things you might pull out for research projects? Is this information on drugs or diseases? What sort of information do you actually drag out?
Okay. We pull out the main clinical types of things that are of interest and use. So we look at diagnoses. We look at what prescriptions people have been issued. We look for things like referral information about where someone might go next, and also pathology laboratory data. We don't take handwritten notes for privacy reasons, I'm trying to think if there's anything. I think that's about. Mm-hmm.
So there's
about
a thing, Shane, for people that aren't familiar with how GPs actually use their electronic medical record. We have a section in there which we call progress notes or clinical notes, where we type lots of things about what our patients are telling us about. That is a section of the file that we're not extracting as part of this, and as Dougie mentioned before, one of the prime reasons why we're not doing that is it often contains identifying data. Yeah. So that's another privacy protecting thing that we're not taking that part of the file.
But presumably with this data, if there was an adverse reaction to a particular drug in a relatively small subset of our community that was only presenting at GP clinics, not necessarily at hospitals, this is the sort of thing that you would be able to identify relatively quickly.
Yes. Absolutely. One interesting thing in the guidelines for the use of data and research is being able to help deal with issues like this. You know, because sometimes you might actually notice something in the data. So we don't know who the person is, but suddenly you notice something that we think there maybe is actually some risk to a patient. So this is one of the good things. There is the potential to be able to pass back to general practice where risks like this eventuate, so that we can help get people.
Is there a chance for real-time data, for example, if all of a sudden influenza is being clicked up on a lot of consultations, that it can be fed back quickly to the GPs, knowing that there's influenza is now being seen in such an area?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah. Certainly we hope some of the research we do is going to feed into areas like that. So we do work, for instance, with the Doherty Institute, who do a lot of national surveillance in that sort of space. So we're certainly hoping that we can start feeding into some of these surveillance opportunities. Yeah, absolutely.
So the technology is there, Jane. Mm-hmm.
Right. And will you be extracting also the observations, for example, blood pressures and pulse rates and
yes.
weights? And
exactly
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
Joanne, there are many practices that have a number of clinicians in them. What would be the scenario if, say, I was one clinician in a practice that didn't want to participate? Does that sort of remove the entire practice from participating or just the clinician?
Within a general practice, Shane, as you can imagine, often patients are seeing different GPs at different times. Also, obviously, if we're extracting lots of data, it'd be very hard for us to make sure that we're maybe not getting that data from our GP who maybe wasn't wanting to be part of the program. So our approach is that actually we want practices to be involved where everybody in the practice is on board. So that is what we're focusing on.
Mm. And what about patient-reported outcomes, where this is a little different again? I mean, is this something that you can utilise in the project?
Yeah, look, I think that's very important. There are some measures such as like a K10, which is something that we do to for people that might have depression and stuff like that. Those are things that we're going to be able to extract from the file. However, in the Department of General Practice, we do lots of other types of studies. We do randomised controlled trials, and a lot of those do include patient-reported outcome measures. So what we are hoping to be able to do is to merge those two different things so that we can have some patient-reported outcome measures that we can match to the data in the patron data set to help provide that really important patient context to the care that's being provided and their experiences of care as well.
Yeah, and of course that's getting that explicit consent then, so if projects where it's involving, speaking to patients and things like that have got... they go through separate ethics and we look for individual consent for doing things
That's
like that.
That's correct. Yeah.
Dougie, before we finish up, I might just ask you, with regards to the practices agreeing to this, what sort of happens next if a practice wants to get involved?
Okay, well, basically it's quite straightforward. We've got a website, Data for Decisions, and all the information there to get in touch with our project coordinator Rachel is available on the website. So we'd be delighted for people to get in touch with us and we look forward to making a difference.
That about wraps things up. Anyone wanting more information about Data for Decisions can visit the website www.gp.unimelb.edu.au/data for decisions. Or contact the Department of General Practice at the University of Melbourne.